If your spouse is to make appropriate adjustments, he or she should understand both your good and bad experiences to know when you can be relied on or when you might need help. A man who's had an affair in the past is particularly vulnerable to another one. If a woman's been chemically dependent in the past, she'll be susceptible to drug or alcohol abuse in the future. If you express your past mistakes openly, your spouse can understand your weaknesses, and together you can avoid conditions that tend to create problems for you. No area of your life should be kept secret. All of your spouse's questions should be answered fully and completely. Periods of poor adjustment in your past should be given special attention, because problems of the past are commonly problems of the future. Not only should you explain your past to your spouse, but you should also encourage your spouse to gather information from those who knew you before you met. Talk with several significant people from each other's past. It can be a very helpful eye-opener. I also encourage you to reveal to each other all romantic relationships you've had in the past. Names should be included along with a description of what happened. But if I tell my wife what I've done, she'll never trust me again. If my husband finds out about my past, he'll be crushed. It will ruin his whole image of me. I've heard these protests from various clients trying to hide their past. Why dig it all up, they ask. Let that old affair stay buried in ancient history. Why not just leave that little demon alone? I answer that it's not a little demon, but an extremely important part of their personal story that says something about their habits and character. But what if you haven't strayed since it happened? What if you've seen a pastor regularly to hold you accountable? Why put your spouse through the agony of a revelation that could ruin your relationship forever? If that's your argument, I'd say you don't give your spouse much credit. Honesty and openness don't drive spouses away. Dishonesty does. When you hold something back, your spouse tries to guess what it is. If he or she is correct, then you must continually lie to cover your tracks. If incorrect, your spouse develops a false understanding of you and your predispositions. Maybe you don't really want to be known for who you are. That's sad, isn't it? You'd really rather keep your secret than experience one of life's greatest joys, to be loved and accepted in spite of known weaknesses? While revealing your past will strengthen your marriage, it's not necessarily painless. Some spouses have difficulty adjusting to revelations that have been kept secret for years. The saint that they thought they married turned out to be a mere mortal. To control the emotional damage of particularly shocking revelations, it may be helpful to express them to your spouse in the presence of a professional counselor. Some people may need some personal support to help them adjust to the reality of their spouse's past. In cases I've witnessed, however, spouses tend to react more negatively to the long-term deception than to the concealed event. The thoughtless act might be accepted and forgiven, but the cover-up is often harder to understand. If you reveal it before your spouse discovers it, though, it's proof that you're taking honesty in your marriage seriously. You may find the idea of revealing your past frightening, and that's understandable. But let me assure you that I've never seen a marriage destroyed by truth. When truth is revealed, there may be negative reactions and some shaky times, but ultimately the truth makes marriages stronger. On the other hand, hiding the truth destroys intimacy, romantic love, and marriages. Current honesty. In good marriages, couples become so interdependent that sharing a daily schedule is essential to their coordination of activities. In weak marriages, spouses are reluctant to reveal their schedules because they often engage in activities that they want to keep from each other. They hide the details of their day, telling themselves, "What he doesn't know won't hurt him," or "She's happier not knowing everything." But let's think back to Ted and Nicole for a moment. Ted's activities were innocent. He didn't do anything that would have been alarming to Nicole. By keeping them secret, however, Ted left Nicole's imagination to run wild. She even suspected he might be having an affair. His failure to meet her basic need for honesty and openness prevented him from making love bank deposits. But her suspicions that he might be having an affair made huge love bank withdrawals. He could have made deposits and avoided withdrawals if he'd simply given her his daily schedule. Make it easy for your spouse to find you in an emergency or to contact you during the day just to say hello. Keep your cell phones close by so that you can call each other 24/7. Current honesty protects your spouse from potentially damaging predispositions and inappropriate activities. When you know that you'll be telling your spouse what you've been up to, you're far less likely to have what I call a secret second life. The easiest way to stay out of trouble is to shine a bright light on everything you do. Honesty and openness is that bright light. Future honesty. After I've made such a big issue of revealing past indiscretions, you can imagine how I feel about revealing future plans. They're much easier to discuss with your spouse. Yet many couples make plans independently of each other. Why? Some people believe that communicating future plans just gives your spouse the opportunity to quash them. They have their sights set on a certain goal, and they don't want anything to stand in their way. But that's short-sighted thinking. If you keep your plan secret, you may succeed in avoiding trouble in the present, but eventually the future will arrive and the plans will be revealed. And at that point, your spouse will be hurt in two ways. First, because you didn't consider your spouse's feelings when you made your plans. And second, because you didn't tell your spouse about them. Love bank withdrawals are certain to be made, so don't overlook this component of an honest and open relationship. I encourage spouses to make a date every Sunday afternoon at 3:30. The primary purpose of that date is to schedule 15 hours of undivided attention for the coming week. If you don't schedule time for undivided attention, it won't happen, and you won't meet each other's basic needs. But another purpose of your date is to review each other's entire schedule for the week. Each of you should know what the other is planning to do because almost everything you do will affect each other. Encouraging honesty. In this chapter, I have primarily focused attention on husbands and their unwillingness to be open and honest. But now I'd like to turn to wives. Do you do anything to discourage your husband in this area? More specifically, do your values encourage or discourage your husband to be honest and open with you? Do your reactions encourage or discourage your husband from revealing the truth, even when it's unpleasant? To see how you rate, answer these questions. 1. If the truth is terribly upsetting to you, do you want your spouse to be honest and open only at a time when you're emotionally prepared? 2. Do you keep some aspects of your life secret, and do you encourage your spouse to respect your privacy in those areas? 3. Do you like to create a certain mystery between you and your spouse? 4. Are there subjects or situations about which you want to avoid radical honesty? 5. Do you ever make selfish demands when your spouse is open and honest with you? 6. Do you ever make disrespectful judgments when your spouse is open and honest with you? 7. Do you ever have angry outbursts when your spouse is open and honest with you? 8. Do you dwell on mistakes when your spouse is open and honest with you? If you answered yes to any of the first four questions, you tend to compromise on the value of honesty and openness. Apparently, you feel your marriage is better off with less information in certain situations. That little crack is all some husbands need to keep their distance emotionally. You see, there are always reasons to be less than radically honest. And as soon as you allow one to sneak in, it will invite all of its friends, too. Before you know it, you'll be having a marriage like Nicole and Ted's. If you answered yes to questions 5, 6, 7, or 8, you're punishing honesty and openness. The way to help your spouse learn to be transparent is to minimize the negative consequences of his truthful revelations. If your spouse is faced with a fight whenever truth is revealed, he'll keep his thoughts to himself. But what if there are no demands, no judgments, no anger, no dwelling on mistakes? If you can eliminate those enemies of intimate conversation, you'll make it much easier for your spouse to be honest and open with you. how mutual honesty can rescue a marriage. What happens when a marriage so lacks honesty and openness that it leads to the ultimate dishonesty of an affair? Can coming clean with your spouse help, or will it spell sure death for the relationship? In a common scenario, I sit down to counsel with a husband who tells me right up front that he's been involved in a series of extramarital affairs. He's never told his wife about any of them, yet he feels terribly guilty about all of them. As therapy proceeds, I suggest that he confess all of this to his wife. With some fear and trepidation, he does so, and she responds with predictable reactions, anger, anxiety, and finally depression. In time, however, she somehow gets through the shock and pain. Then they can begin to build their marriage on mutual honesty, perhaps for the first time. When a couple deal with trying to survive an affair, I train them to become thoroughly candid with each other. They must conceal nothing of what they think or feel. Only through total openness can an honest relationship emerge. If they compromise at any point, it will only undermine the rebuilding process. You may wonder if it's always wise for the strained spouse to confess his or her sins to the other. In my experience, having the straying mate confess has never been a primary cause of a divorce. Some couples do go on to get a divorce because of the affair, but not because they've finally spoken honestly with each other. Instead, it's quite common for the betrayed spouse, husband or wife, to emerge from the initial shock of learning about the affair, willing to examine and consider ways to resolve the marriage's problem. In chapter 13 of this book, How to Survive an Affair, I explain how to turn this willingness of the betrayed spouse to give the marriage a chance into complete marital recovery. In the end, trust is restored because the unfaithful spouse learns how to be honest and open. A husband with a history of secrecy may insist that his confession of the affair by itself proves he is reformed. He may want his wife to begin to trust him again immediately, but here I disagree. You cannot turn on trust like a light switch. Rather, it takes numerous experiences of his honesty and openness to prove himself trustworthy to his wife. As I mentioned earlier, I recommend strongly that the husband provide his wife with his daily schedule, which she can easily check for accuracy. If the schedule changes throughout the day, he should try his best to notify her immediately. She should be able to call some of the places he's listed on his schedule to verify his presence. Usually, the couple can handle this process of verification in a way that avoids any embarrassment to either husband or wife. The husband often resists having to provide his wife with this kind of information. He may complain about legalism, childish rule-keeping, and he says, "All this checking will only prove she doesn't trust me after all." And that's just the point. She doesn't. In response, I simply comment that a well-organized person plans a schedule. Why should he be reluctant to share it with his wife? A wife should feel free to call her husband any time during the day, even in relationships that exhibit no problem with trust. I provide that information to Joyce every day, and I've never had an affair. It's what people do who have great marriages. With the procedure I've outlined, it may take years before trust is restored. Gradually, however, the wife finds, through repeated verification, that her husband is being honest with her. The typical woman needs the ability to communicate with her husband any time of the day or night to sustain this feeling of openness and honesty. Most women will not abuse the privilege by calling her husband out of important meetings or otherwise interrupting him at work. However, the wife must know that she can call if she wants to, and that when she calls, her trust in her husband is confirmed. Before we move on to the next chapter, I must make one other very important point regarding trust. While honesty and openness are essential in building trust, our behavior must also be trustworthy. Everything you decide to do must protect the feelings and interests of your spouse if you are to be trusted. If you tell your spouse everything you do each day, and yet you do what you please with no regard for the effect it has on him or her, how do you expect your spouse to trust you? It's only when you're honest and open, and also making every decision with your spouse's interests in mind, that you build a strong foundation for trust. I developed this important concept more fully in the opening chapters of Love Busters. A woman needs to trust her husband, and her husband's openness and honesty with her goes a long way to enable her to do that. Whatever advantage a man may gain in being secretive, closed, or even dishonest, he gains at the expense of his wife's security and marital fulfillment. She must come to find him predictable. A blending of her mind with his should exist so she can read his mind. When a husband becomes that transparent, she is fulfilled. The two become one. Let me quickly review the policy of radical honesty with you and its four parts. The policy of radical honesty. Reveal to your spouse as much information about yourself as you know. Your thoughts, feelings, habits, likes, dislikes, past history, daily activities, and future plans. Part 1. Emotional honesty. Reveal your emotional reactions, both positive and negative, to the events of your life, particularly your spouse's behavior. Part 2. Historical honesty. Reveal information about your personal history, particularly events that demonstrate personal weaknesses or failure. Part 3. Current honesty. Reveal information about the events of your day. Provide your spouse with a calendar of your activities with special emphasis on those that may affect him or her. Part 4. Future honesty. Reveal your thoughts and plans regarding future activities and objectives. Questions for him. 1. What parts of my policy of radical honesty are difficult for you? Emotional honesty, historical honesty, current honesty, or future honesty? Why are they difficult? 2. Do you agree with the contention that there should be no privacy in your marriage? That is, neither of you should keep facts regarding yourself from the other. Why or why not? 3. Does your wife encourage or discourage honesty and openness? Does she do this with her values and or her reactions to your honesty? Questions for her. 1. In your personal hierarchy of needs, how essential is your husband's honesty and openness? Do you agree that honesty and openness is one of your 5 basic needs in marriage? Why or why not? 2. Has your husband made it difficult for you to understand him? Has he kept his thoughts and feelings, personal history, current activities, or plans for the future from you? If so, how does this make you feel? 3. In what ways do you wish your husband were more honest and open with you? Do you wish for more emotional honesty, historical honesty, current honesty, and/or future honesty? To consider together. 1. Discuss your answers to the above questions. It will be a good test of how open and honest your marriage really is. 2. In the questionnaires section of the Marriage Builder's website, print 2 copies of the personal history questionnaire form, 1 for each of you. After you've completed the forms, read each other's answers and discuss them. Freely ask questions that are triggered by any of the answers you read. 3. If either of you need help overcoming dishonesty, read together Chapter 6, Dishonesty, in Love Busters. It will offer you a plan to help rid your marriage of this very destructive habit. Chapter 8. He Needs a Good-Looking Wife. Physical Attractiveness. At 26 and 190 pounds, Brittany seldom had dates, 4 in the last 2 years to be exact, and no callbacks after the first one. Her prospects for marriage seemed bleak, to say the least. Even though she had a charming personality and many interests, few men wanted to date her. One day Brittany decided she had to make a change. She wanted to marry, and she was tired of her job. If I had someone to take care of me, she thought, I could quit the job and do something I'd enjoy. I'd like that. As her first tactic in achieving that goal, Brittany enrolled in an exercise program, went on a diet, and lost 60 pounds. Next, she bought some new clothes, and that nicely accentuated her slender figure. A new hairdo and appropriate makeup completed the transformation. With 60 pounds gone and the other improvements, Brittany was a real knockout. Now she had dates right and left, but she had not forgotten her goal, a husband. About 8 months later, when Josh proposed, she said yes. She had achieved her goal with great speed. When I counseled Brittany and Josh about 5 years later, I started by talking with them separately. Josh told me, the first thing she did after we were married was quit her job. Then she stayed home, eating like mad all day. She blew up like a balloon. She's gained about 100 pounds since we've been married. Have you said anything to her about her weight? I asked. Yes, many times. In fact, it's a sore point between us. But she just says, I want you to love me for who I am. If you'd love me and accept me unconditionally, then I could easily lose the weight. But the less I say, the more weight she gains, Josh continued. I'm finding myself more attracted to other women. I can't handle this. Something has to happen. As we continued to talk, I could see that Josh faced a real dilemma. Reared in a conservative church, he had held strong convictions about being faithful, but he found himself married to a wife whose figure repulsed him. He had almost no interest in making love with her anymore. When he married her, he had looked forward to a happy future with a wife who was very physically attractive to him. But now life with Brittany seemed like a prison sentence. He believed his only hope for a romantic relationship was in having an affair, and his convictions were weakening. Next, I talked to Brittany to get her side. She confessed to me that she had launched a self-improvement program to get dates and a husband, and also admitted that she never told Josh that she had once weighed so much. When she married Josh, she thought he would love her regardless of her weight, and that she could go back to being fat and happy. So when he told her he was tempted to be in another relationship, she felt terribly hurt. She had thought that once Josh got to know and love her, her weight would no longer matter to him. But she was wrong. Granted, some men don't care about physical appearance. Their wives can be overweight or underweight. Makes no difference. They have other emotional needs that are far more important to them than the need for physical attractiveness. But Brittany had not married one of these men. In fact, she had married a man for whom physical appearance was near the very top of his list. He needed an attractive wife. Some women also have a need for an attractive husband. Many wives I've counseled have given their husbands the ultimate threat. Either lose weight or our marriage is over. One woman I counseled would not live with her husband until he had lost 50 pounds. Brittany listened intently as I explained that marriage commitment means meeting the basic needs of your spouse. She wanted Josh to earn a good living, be affectionate to her, and talk with her often, which he had done since they had been married. But she wasn't holding up her end of the bargain. "What do you mean not holding up my end?" she snapped. "I cook good meals, I keep the house clean, I'm affectionate." "All that is good, but you're missing something," I explained. "Your physical attractiveness is very important to your husband. This isn't some quirk or whim. It's something he needs very badly. The beautiful woman he married hides under all that excess weight. By taking care of your body, you take care of your husband." Brittany didn't quite hear me at first. She persisted in arguing. "Josh should love me as I am." "We all want to be loved for who we are, and not for what we do," I said. "But you didn't decide to marry your husband for who he is, but rather for what he did. If he had not met any of your basic emotional needs when you dated him, you would not have considered him as a life partner. And if after you were married he stopped meeting those needs, your feelings for him would have changed considerably. Your love would have faded away, and just like Josh, you would have felt trapped." Many men think that the emotional needs of women, such as affection and intimate conversation, are trivial needs. Many women think that the emotional needs of men are trivial, but they're not trivial to those who have them. Even though Brittany knew that she had to have a slim figure to attract a husband, she thought that physical attractiveness was trivial because she didn't have that need. So she concluded that Josh's shallow sense of values was the culprit. If he would just grow up and be more mature, he would look beyond her appearance, and she could gain as much weight as she wanted. Why all the fuss about looking good? People often challenge me when I list physical attractiveness as one of the basic emotional needs of most men. In fact, some have written me that when they came to this chapter, they lost all confidence in my judgment. Shouldn't we be looking beyond the surface and to more meaningful human characteristics, such as honesty, trust, and caring? Besides, what if a woman simply can't look attractive because of her heredity? Does that mean she's destined to be unloved? As I mentioned earlier, not all men have a basic need for physical attractiveness. They marry women who meet other basic needs. But in Josh's case, he chose Brittany because she met this need so effectively while they were dating. And Brittany worked hard to look attractive right up to the day of their wedding. If she had wanted to marry a man who would accept a heavier woman, she should not have lost the weight prior to dating. Besides gaining weight after her wedding, Brittany also quit her job. But Josh never complained about that change because he didn't have a need that I'll introduce in the next chapter, the need for financial support. He was happy to support her financially as long as she met his basic emotional needs. What if Josh had left his job, expecting Brittany to support him? Would she have accepted him the way he was? This argument that Josh should have the right to leave his job if she has the right to gain weight finally convinced Brittany. She realized that if he decided to stay at home and let her support him, she wouldn't be accepting him so unconditionally. The only reason she felt unconditional love for him was that he was already meeting her basic emotional needs, an essential condition for her continuing love for him. So she enrolled in an exercise program, went on a diet, and lost 40 pounds in about 3 months. Once Josh saw that she meant business, he joined her in the exercise program. A year later, she had lost the weight she'd gained since their wedding. Brittany's program of self-improvement was not only a gesture of care for Josh, it was also a very effective way to care for herself. Once she got down to a desirable weight, Josh liked the result, and she did too. It greatly improved her health and feeling of self-esteem. Beauty, of course, is in the eye of the beholder, and I'm not encouraging a wife to try to look like a beauty queen. I simply mean that she should try to look the way her husband likes her to look. She should resemble the woman he married. Does that mean a woman must stay eternally young? Of course not. But getting old is not an excuse for gaining weight and dressing poorly. This is exactly what Brittany had done, and it made Josh feel cheated. Josh and Brittany's story ended happily, but many do not. I have counseled other wives and husbands who have refused to improve their physical appearance. In doing so, they miss an opportunity to provide essential care to their mate that would make huge love bank deposits. They also greatly increase the risk of their spouse having an affair. When she looks good, he feels good. A man with a need for an attractive spouse feels good whenever he looks at his attractive wife. In fact, that's what emotional needs are all about. When one of his emotional needs are met, he feels fulfilled. And when it's not met, he feels frustrated. It may sound immature or superficial to some, but I've found that most men have a need for physical attractiveness. They appreciate a good-looking wife. Women want their husbands to look decent, and they might admit that attractive men get their attention. But I found that most women do not rank physical attraction among their top five emotional needs. They are far more likely to fall in love with men who meet other basic emotional needs, such as affection, intimate conversation, honesty and openness, financial support, and family commitment. I remember an overweight, balding man who was 20 years older than his very pretty wife. Nonetheless, she was crazy about him, and they shared a very active sex life. What did she see in him? That's just the point. Instead of looking at him, she looked within him and found a warm and sensitive man, kind and generous, who loved her as deeply as she loved him. To her, he was rather nice-looking. Was she more mature than her husband, who was admittedly attracted by her appearance? No, she simply had different emotional needs. For her, physical attractiveness did not do as much for her as it did for him. She put effort into making herself look good because she knew it would make him happy. In return, he put effort into meeting her needs for affection, intimate conversation, and financial support. Any woman can enhance her attractiveness to her husband. There are plenty of books, videos, diet programs, and other products designed to help women and men shape up, dress with style, color their hair properly, and so forth. When I counsel wives who want to improve their physical appearance, I focus attention on five major areas that are particularly important in staying or becoming attractive. Let's give them a quick survey. The Secret to Weight Control. Every year, several new books appear offering the latest foolproof diet or weight control plan. Here's mine. I call it Harley's Second Corollary. Balance your intake of calories with the proper amount of exercise. I'm sorry I can't sound more sensational, effortless, or intriguing, but there's no secret to weight and figure control. It takes discipline, and that's been known for centuries. I counsel many women who just don't believe me. They keep hoping for some revolutionary new gimmick that will solve their weight problem with little or no effort, or they crash diet and soon gain it all back. Then they crash diet again and again. Sooner or later, they give up, heavier than ever. The truth is that weight control programs work only when they are a way of life, based on the facts of life. All human bodies, including female ones, are machines that burn fuel. When the body takes in too much fuel and doesn't burn it off, it stores the fuel in the form of fat. So if you want to avoid getting fat, you must burn all the fuel your body takes in. To lose weight, you must burn even more fuel. Fuel, of course, is what you eat, and you burn it with exercise. You burn some of it by just sitting around, but it burns much faster with exercise. If you exercise often, you can afford to eat more because you're burning more fuel. From my perspective, however, it's much easier to eat less than it is to exercise more. A popular approach to dieting is to consume 4 300-calorie meals a day, spaced 4 hours apart. Healthy, frozen 300-calorie meals that can be prepared in a microwave oven are readily available in the grocery store. When a woman limits her food intake to these 4 meals a day, she usually loses about 2 pounds a week if she eats nothing else. Most men can eat 5 of these meals a day with the same results. Yes, I know, you think you're addicted to food. But so is everybody. We all die of hunger without it. Hunger is a normal reaction to weight loss because your bodies are programmed to prevent weight loss. But that doesn't mean you can't eat less. It simply means you'll be somewhat hungry while you're doing it. But by eating small meals 4 hours apart, you'll minimize your hunger. Keep your intake of sugar and fat to a minimum. If you're tempted to binge on something with lots of calories, ice cream or potato chips, for example, don't even buy it. That may be the only way to avoid being out of control. Your children and your husband may complain, but they'll be as healthy as you. Aerobic exercise will help you lose even more of the extra pounds while keeping your heart and lungs healthy. All it takes is enough exercise to increase your heart rate 60 to 70% of its maximum for about 30 minutes every other day. To find your maximum heart rate, subtract your age from 220. Then to find your best aerobic heart rate for your age, multiply your maximum heart rate by 0.70. Joyce and I share the same diet program, and we also exercise with each other whenever possible. We encourage each other in weight control. Both of us come from families where there's been a tendency to gain weight in later years, and we've made an agreement with each other to avoid that outcome. If you've agreed to lose weight and keep it off, you must create a new lifestyle around diet and exercise, and your spouse should be a part of it. It may mean that he'll have to avoid foods that are not on your diet and join you in an exercise program. When both of you are committed to this new lifestyle, the chances that it will succeed are greatly increased. The use of makeup. Rose came to my office looking more like a clown than a well-made-up woman. Although she might have had some attractive features, they lay buried beneath a mass of colors vying for attention. In her effort to make herself attractive, something had gone wrong. She hadn't used the makeup to her advantage. Cosmetics have been around since ancient Egyptian times, and with our modern multi-billion-dollar cosmetic industry, no woman has the excuse that help is not available. Most women who use no makeup or use it inappropriately simply lack the initiative to get the help they need. Some women have never learned to apply makeup to their best advantage. As in Rose's case, I sometimes step in where angels fear to tread and suggest she might seek professional advice. Some cosmetic studios or large department stores provide free consultations. Of course, much depends on the knowledge of the person who gives the consultation, but many can give good advice. Women's magazines also publish articles that will help achieve the same goal. I found that eye makeup, along with eyebrow shaping, tends to be the most important. I've seen many women make dramatic improvements in their appearance just by applying makeup more effectively. Almost always when single women make these changes, single men pay more attention and ask them out on dates. The husbands of women who make an effort to improve their use of makeup appreciate and encourage the change if their wife has done it for them. While your objective is to meet his need for physical attractiveness, you should also like the change as well. Don't use cosmetics in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable. A hairstyle he likes. Most women are particularly sensitive to how their hair looks. Yearly, they spend billions on dyes, rinses, shampoos, perms, sets, and cuts. My questions are, why and for whom? If a wife spends all that time and money to please her husband and to achieve something she likes, well and good. But if she lets some hairdresser talk her into something she knows her husband won't like, she's begun to work against herself and her marriage. A certain hair color manufacturer excuses the high price of their product by telling the woman, "You're worth it." More to the point, your husband's worth it. If he doesn't like a certain hairstyle and color, abandon it. In fact, consult with him ahead of time to get his opinion before ever getting a different style or color. After all, the whole idea is to be attractive to him. Or is it? Some women object to this idea. They insist on the right to please themselves, or they argue that having to please their husband in such a way seems unfair and even degrading. I don't encourage women to accept meekly a hairstyle that makes them miserable. Certainly, they need to enjoy their own looks and feel attractive. If a husband likes something his wife can't tolerate, negotiation is in order. Among the many hairstyles available, I'm certain they can find one on which they can agree. Hairstyles, like everything else, can create deposits or withdrawals in a husband's love bank. If a wife understands her husband's need for physical attractiveness, she'll work with him to achieve that goal. In my experience, chances are great that she'll find that her husband has fairly good taste. The importance of the right clothes. The old adage tells us, clothes make the man. But in our society, clothes showcase the woman. That showcase can enhance and flatter, or do something far less than that. As with cosmetics and hairstyle, the same principle applies. Dress to be attractive to your husband and comfortable with your own look. Fashions come and go, and in certain years, clothing styles range from silly to disastrous. Despite the insistence of some clothes designers to be eternally creative, one rule seems to prevail. When women's clothing becomes unappealing to most men, it does not stay popular very long. A woman should pay as much, if not more, attention to her choice of nightgown or pajamas as she does to what she wears in public. When she dresses for bed, she dresses strictly for her husband. Wearing old and bedraggled nightclothes, curlers, and goop on her face will not make love bank deposits. Wearing a worn-out nightgown to bed because nobody will see it misses an important point. One very special and important person does see it, so why not wear something attractive? Your husband will certainly appreciate it. Personal hygiene. To be honest, I've hardly ever counseled a woman who needed help with her personal hygiene, but I've helped many men with this problem. Since the need for an attractive spouse is sometimes a wife's need, hygiene is a subject that should be addressed in this chapter. Kent was a very successful farmer. He was worth millions. When he asked Jessica to marry him, all she could think about was his millions. He was a decent man, but having been single for the better part of his adult life, had paid little attention to his appearance. Jessica thought she could overlook his outward appearance and love him for his inner qualities and his money. After they were married, however, she found his appearance turned her off completely. When they came for the first appointment, Ken complained that Jessica refused to make love to him. She came up with every excuse, and he finally thought a counselor might help. "I just can't have sex with him," she explained. "When I married him, I thought he would be more appealing to me, but it's getting worse. He'll probably divorce me, but I just can't do it. When Ken came into my office, his body odor just about knocked me over. He had been chewing tobacco, and his teeth were caked with residue. His hair was a mess, and his clothes looked like he'd slept in them. I had counseled many men who had trouble keeping themselves clean, but Kent was beyond anything I could have imagined." "She doesn't like sex," was his explanation for their problem. I had a different theory. "I think I can help you," I replied, "but you have to do everything I recommend. Within a few weeks, I think your problem will be solved." I gave him this assignment: take a shower every morning and evening. With Jessica's help, buy a new wardrobe of clothes. Let Jessica pick out clothes for you to wear each day. Never wear anything you've worn the day before unless it's been washed. Go to a dentist and have your teeth cleaned. Never chew tobacco in Jessica's presence and brush your teeth before being with her. Comb your hair and shave every morning before breakfast. Fulfilling this assignment was quite a commitment for Kent. He was used to going weeks without a shower. He wore the same pants and shirt day after day and hadn't been to a dentist since he was a teenager. But he agreed to it, believing me when I said it would help his sexual relationship with Jessica. Then I gave Jessica her assignment: shop with Kent for clothes. Pick out something for him to wear every day and see to it that those clothes are clean. I also asked her if she'd be willing to make love to him every day for just 1 week after he followed through on his assignment. A deal was struck, and Kent was off to the dentist and clothing store. He kept his part of the bargain, and Jessica kept hers. After he had clean teeth, clean clothes, and a clean body, Jessica made love to him once a day for a week. At their next appointment, I could hardly recognize Kent. What a transformation! And they were holding hands in the waiting room. All on their own, without my counsel, they had made a long-term agreement. She would make love to him if he would keep himself clean. Their sexual problems were over. I'm sure they didn't make love every day from then on, but they were both satisfied with the new sexual compatibility. Kent had learned a very important lesson about Jessica. His physical appearance, especially his smell, was important to her sexually. At first, she wanted to believe that outward appearance was not important, that she should love him in spite of his appearance. But the changes he made in his personal hygiene proved that her need for an attractive spouse was greater than she had been willing to admit. The hygiene problems of most men are not as extreme as Kent's, but lesser problems can still have a devastating effect on wives, especially while making love. A woman wants to be physically close to the man she loves, especially if he looks and smells good. The value of making the most of what you have. If you're still unconvinced that physical attractiveness is a worthy objective, consider what it means to be physically attractive. It simply means that your appearance makes someone feel good. You meet an emotional need by the way you look. People can be attractive in many ways. Those with attractive personalities also meet an emotional need, but they usually deposit love units with the quality of their conversation or affection rather than their appearance. In fact, whenever someone meets any of our emotional needs, we consider that person attractive. If physical attractiveness meets an emotional need of your spouse, why ignore it? Why not deposit love units whenever you have a chance? For some, like Brittany at the beginning of this chapter, the prospect of becoming physically attractive seems completely out of reach. These women have fallen for the lie that some women are born attractive while others are not. But they can discover the truth of Harley's third corollary: attractiveness is what you do with what you have. Every woman would benefit from evaluating each aspect of the image she projects: her posture, hairstyle, clothing, gestures, makeup, weight, and so forth. She should ask her husband for his honest appraisal, and if possible, consult professionals or trustworthy friends. Then she should decide where change is needed and set realistic goals for making those changes. For some, the changes might be completed in a week, while for others, it could take years. But in the end, the makeover would have such significance that it would be life-changing for the better. Lydia, a client who suffered from depression, demonstrated dramatically how a woman can profit from an improved appearance. This exceptionally bright and charming woman wanted dates with men who were truly on a par with her. But she had not given her appearance the attention it needed. I reminded her how important appearance is to most men. Granted, it was not one of her emotional needs. She could not have cared less how the men she dated looked. But it was likely that the man of her dreams would have a need for a wife who was physically attractive. And if she wanted to attract him, she'd have to meet that need. Her metamorphosis took 6 months to accomplish. At the end of that time, Lydia was a stunningly attractive woman. Men she already knew and liked started dating her. Her depression disappeared entirely, and she no longer needed my services. When I saw Lydia for the last time, I reminded her not to make the same mistake that Brittany had made, shaping up to attract a man and then letting herself go after marriage. Lydia knew that the changes she had made to attract a husband would have to be permanent, because the emotional need she could meet by being attractive would continue to be there after marriage. If you know how to make your spouse feel good, doesn't it make sense to go ahead and do it whenever you can? Often, a wife's attractiveness is a vital ingredient to the success of her marriage, and any woman who ignores this notion, for whatever reason, risks disaster. This is true for some men as well. The changes in appearance I've witnessed in my clients have not only met spouses' needs, but have also made my clients feel much better about themselves. The changes have made them more successful in business and have improved their health. It's one of those efforts that pays dividends in ways that go far beyond the marriage itself. When a woman sees her husband's response to her improved appearance, she knows she's made the right decision because it's met one of his basic needs. Her account in his love bank will get a substantial deposit every time he sees her. Questions for her. 1. Do you take your husband's need for you to be attractive seriously? If not, why not? 2. Does your husband really like the way you look most of the time? Do you? 3. How much care do you take in the way you look? How is your figure? Do you use cosmetics to good advantage? Do you change your hairstyle from time to time to please your husband by giving him a little variety in the way you look? Questions for him. 1. Are you willing to admit that physical attractiveness is one of your most basic needs in your marriage? If not, why not? 2. Has your wife's appearance become less attractive since your wedding? Do you really like the way she looks, or do you just say you do? 3. If your wife told you she was willing to change anything she could about her physical appearance, what would you ask her to change? Why? To consider together. 1. Sit down with your collection of photographs, especially those from the days you were dating and from your wedding day. Compare the way you look then to the way you look today. Do you need to make some changes? How? 2. Share your answers to the above questions with each other. Be respectful but honest. 3. How can you help your spouse become more physically attractive to you? Chapter 9. She needs enough money to live comfortably. Financial support. Taylor had been raised in an upper-middle-class American home. She attended the State University, where she majored in art history, and John. They married while still in school. John finished his undergraduate work and also earned a master's degree in fine arts. But once he was out of school, he could find no work that utilized his training. He tried to move into the world of commercial art, but the competition was fierce. 2 years after graduation, he had still not found full-time work. He kept very busy with his painting and drawing, but but his income was poor and unpredictable. During the first 6 years of their marriage, his jobs or assignments never lasted longer than 6 months. Consequently, Taylor found herself working full-time as a receptionist to help make ends meet. She wanted to have children, but their finances prevented it. They lived in a modest apartment. Little money was available for extras, and they could afford only one inexpensive car. Taylor knew several young executives at work who had started to climb the ladder of success. They all looked terrific to Taylor, dressed handsomely in $1,000 suits. Some were already earning income several times higher than John's would ever be. Alan was one of those executives, and he was attracted to Taylor. On several occasions, she had helped him make sales by her skillful handling of customers on the telephone and in the lobby. That had motivated him to work more closely with her, and from time to time he would stop by her desk just to talk. The more he got to know her, the more he liked her. During their conversations, Alan often heard Taylor say things like, "I feel so bad for John. He's so good at what he does, but it's hard for an artist to find a steady job." One day she broke down and started crying. "Taylor." His voice conveyed more compassion than alarm. "I don't think John will ever earn much," she sobbed. "We'll never have anything." "It's probably none of my business, but John has a good thing going," Alan suggested. "He can spend all day enjoying art while you're here supporting him. If he hadn't married you, he'd be working like the rest of us. I don't think he's being fair to you." That started Taylor thinking. "John is using me," she thought. "He's doing what he enjoys at my expense. If he cared about me, he'd give up his artwork for a profession that could support us." She became increasingly resentful about how trapped she was. As time went by, Taylor and Alan became good friends. They began to talk sales, first at her desk at odd moments, then at coffee breaks, and finally at lunch almost every day. He reminded Taylor of her father, who was also a businessman, ambitious and prosperous. The more she came to know Alan, the more she felt it had been a mistake to marry John. By predictable stages, the friendship grew into an affair. The weekend John had gone out of town to interview for a part-time teaching position, Alan invited Taylor to join him on his boat. That was the first of many times they made love. The job didn't come through, but it started Taylor thinking that someday she might be forced to move away from Alan so John could take a job somewhere else. Or worse yet, John might discover her affair. To avoid those and other unpleasant prospects, she filed for divorce. A year later, she married Alan. Do women marry men for their money? Humorous anecdotes abound about women who marry men for their money, but my counseling experience has taught me not to treat this tendency as a joke. In truth, a woman does marry a man for his money. She wants him to earn at least enough to support himself. I can recall talking to a woman who had a problem very similar to Taylor's. Her marriage was intensely unhappy due to her husband's low income, but she insisted she would never stoop to divorce to resolve the problem. "Don is loyal and affectionate. I'd never be so selfish and uncaring as to leave him just because he doesn't make enough money." "Oh," I replied, "do you always feel that way?" "Of course I do. Leaving a man who doesn't make enough money is a low-down selfish thing to do." Olivia seemed to know her mind and convinced me she would stick it out. But 2 weeks later, she missed her appointment with me because she had filed for divorce and felt too ashamed to tell me about it. After the divorce was finalized, she married a man who earned considerably more money than her former husband. Why did Olivia make such loud protests against stooping to divorce, when in the end, she did not really have that strong commitment to marriage? Actually, she didn't exhibit very unusual behavior. I counsel many people who become what I call verbally rigid just before they crack. I believe Olivia's inconsistent actions resulted from a struggle deep within her between her values and her need for financial support. The incredibly powerful need to have enough money won over her commitment and her good intentions. For the past 50 years, I've witnessed a revolution in the workforce. When I started my career as a psychologist, men dominated the field. My class of 25 PhD candidates included only 2 women. Today, women dominate psychology. But the revolution has not affected only my profession. Overall, women now outnumber men in most careers. They are the working majority. So you might think that the cultural shift toward women in the workplace would change a woman's need for financial support. Apparently, that's not been the case. As a test of whether women still marry for money, I will sometimes ask an audience of young couples a question.